The recent practice of Republican governors from southern border states of transporting thousands of asylum seekers to New York City has thrust the municipality's quote-unquote right-to-shelter law into the spotlight, raising renewed concerns about how it's implemented and what we, as a society, owe our most vulnerable citizens. For more on the issue of homelessness, including the state's role in providing temporary housing relief, we're joined on the Capitol Press Room by Shelley Nortz, Deputy Executive Director for Policy at the Coalition for the Homeless, the country's oldest advocacy and direct service organization for homeless individuals and families. Welcome back to the show, Shelley.
Thanks, Dave. Nice to see you.
Well, let's start our conversation by exploring the backdrop of New York City's right-to-shelter policy, which, if I'm not mistaken, has its roots in a 1979 lawsuit from your organization. Can you explain what that case was about and how it led to the system that we have now in the five boroughs?
In 1979, a lawsuit named Callahan versus Carey was brought against the city and state of New York by a group of people that formed to create the Coalition for the Homeless, our founders, including a lawyer named Robert Hayes and Ellen Baxter, Kim Hopper, some people who were very involved in the early onset of mass homelessness as it reemerged in New York City in the 1970s. That lawsuit was based on the Article 17 of the New York State Constitution that provides that the aid, care, and support of needy individuals is a responsibility of the state and localities, and identifies a role for the legislature in identifying how that need shall be met. But it is an absolute right to assistance for needy individuals under our Constitution. Callahan produced, after a couple of years of litigation, something called a consent decree, which is a court order agreed to by the parties that established minimum standards for shelters in New York City for homeless men. It subsequently was modified to include homeless adult women, and separate litigation was brought on behalf of homeless families with minor children by the Legal Aid Society, which is a close ally of the Coalition for the Homeless. We work kind of arm in arm on those issues of the right to shelter.
Well, in the subsequent four decades since the expansion of that consent decree to include, like you said, men, women, and children, how have city officials approached this responsibility?
You know, it has varied by administration. Mayor Koch wasn't happy about it at the time, and recruited faith groups to supplement the city obligation to provide shelter. There's still a kind of remnant of that system that kind of operates in parallel to the formal shelter system, but it's pretty small. There were mayors that argued that it should be eliminated, and certainly Mayor Giuliani and Mayor Bloomberg bristled at the obligation. On the other hand, Mayor de Blasio was more amenable to the fulfillment of the city's obligations under the consent decree and related lawsuits. I think the thing that's been missing through the entire period is the notion that shelter is a solution for the near term, but what the city really has to grapple with, and the state as well, is how to solve homelessness so that we don't need that temporary solution. And that means addressing the decades-long affordable housing crisis that the city and state continue to endure.
So you mentioned that this initial lawsuit was brought citing language in the state constitution. So if this is something that utilized the state constitution to make its case, does that mean municipalities outside of New York City have a responsibility to provide at least temporary shelter?
Certainly they do. The State Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance, which was formerly named the New York State Department of Social Services, since the 1980s has directed localities to provide shelter to homeless individuals and families who are in what is referred to as immediate need and who are found within the boundaries of that jurisdiction. The exception is that if they can prove that the household is ineligible, then that requirement disappears. That has been met with varied compliance and enforcement throughout the state. There are communities where it extended beyond the right to shelter to an obligation of the locality to actually provide rental assistance to an already homeless household so that they could leave shelters and move into housing. But it has also been something that the state and advocates and lawyers have had to go to court to enforce when households have been ignored by a local social service district, a county welfare department that just turns people away. And that problem has varied over time. There were times when it was a rampant problem, and there were times when the state agency overseeing this responsibility has gone out and done very forceful enforcement in upstate localities that were refusing to help homeless people.
For listeners just joining us, you're listening to the Capitol Press Room, and we're talking with Shelley Nortz, Deputy Executive Director for Policy at the Coalition for the Homeless, the country's oldest advocacy and direct service organization for homeless individuals and families. Well, what does compliance with the right to shelter principle actually look like? For example, is there a general consensus about what the basic standards for a homeless shelter look like?
There are. The New York State Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance has two principal regulations that regulate what are referred to as certified or licensed shelters. One set of regulations for shelters for adults, and one set of regulations for families with minor children. There is a relatively new third prong to this regulatory framework, which regulates uncertified facilities. And that was added just at the beginning of the pandemic, in part in response to a comptroller's report that criticized OTDA for failing to enforce regulations for uncertified facilities that might present a danger to the individual staying there. The general system in New York for regulating shelters is part of the welfare system, and that is often referred to as a state-supervised, locally administered system. So localities have the kind of operational responsibility to either run the facilities or contract for their operation with generally not-for-profit organizations. The state has regulatory oversight and has this body of regulation. Both entities are required to inspect shelter facilities, and the state participates financially in reimbursing the locality for the expense.
And what does enforcement of all of this look like? Because I have to imagine that aggressive enforcement might highlight some holes in this safety net, which end up costing either the state or New York City more money, and thus they don't have necessarily an incentive to be aggressive with their policing.
So the enforcement takes various forms. We have the original Callahan and related court orders, and we can go to court at any time if the standards in that original consent decree or the family court orders are not being complied with. That's one mechanism. Another mechanism is the regulations themselves have enforcement provisions that include things like fines and withholding reimbursement. There's a separate pot of money in the state budget every year that is set aside just to reimburse New York City for all of the violations that they've had over the decades, because it accumulated to be so sizable in state fines that they actually had to provide a separate mechanism of reimbursing the city as they came into compliance over time. So there's I think it's a $10 million pot of money that reimburses New York City as they effect compliance with the regulations. There are also consequences that are born out of comptroller reports. The comptroller doesn't have, I think, an ability to fine the operators, but they have the ability to use their public platform to expose noncompliance and embarrass the city and state, as well as the providers, for failing to comply with the rules.
Well, then sticking with state funding for homeless needs, aside from this $10 million just to make up some of the delinquent efforts of New York City, what sort of investment does New York put up to meet the needs of homeless New Yorkers? And how have we seen that investment ebb and flow over the decades?
The system has grown from a hundreds of millions of dollars system to a billions of dollars system at this point. There are tens of thousands of people in shelters, sleeping in shelters every single night. And the bulk of that expense is borne by the city of New York for two reasons. One is about 85% of the homeless population in New York State is in New York City. So just by definition, the bulk of the resources there. But secondly, New York State has capped its reimbursement to New York City for shelter-related expenses. And Governor Cuomo modified various reimbursement systems to really shift the cost from the state coffer to the city of New York. So there are several pots of money in the state budget every year that we take a look at. These are appropriations in the bills that spend money for social services that provide a capped amount to operate shelters for single adults, a capped amount to operate those facilities outside New York City. And then within the body of reimbursement for welfare, some strict rules about what can and cannot go to the city of New York for sheltering families with minor children. So there are, as I say, billions of dollars that are required to operate this system, most of which is paid for by the city of New York at present.
Did New York City officials respond to the changing dynamic under the Cuomo administration by increasing their share of what was invested into the needs of homeless New Yorkers, or did spending basically just stay flat?
No, it went up. By definition, the way the whole system is structured is that the state's money is a reimbursement of a local expense. So the city has to expend the resource and then seek state reimbursement. We allied with the de Blasio administration to try to fix those problems. Our annual State of the Homeless report each year kind of chronicled how serious the cost of that expense has been to the city from the state under those new rules. The New York City Independent Budget Office has done similar documentation of this problem. It's really unfair in a state that is otherwise one that shares responsibility with localities for public services, social services, on a pretty much a 50-50 basis, absent the federal financial participation. And this broke that rule and is really a problem.
And after a quick break, we'll continue our conversation with Shelley Nortz, Deputy Executive Director for Policy at the Coalition for the Homeless.
Support for Capital Press Room provided by the New York State Department of Agriculture and Markets, working to help consumers identify local agricultural products through the New York Grown and Certified label. More at nysgrown.com.
For listeners just joining us, we're continuing our conversation about the state of the homeless services in New York in the wake of an influx of housing demands from people who were shipped to New York City from our country's southern border by Republican governors. And our guest is Shelley Nortz, Deputy Executive Director for Policy at the Coalition for the Homeless, the country's oldest advocacy and direct service organization for homeless individuals and families. In response to the influx of asylum seekers in New York City, officials opened up about two dozen emergency shelters. What can this type of emergency housing look like, and how long could or should it be used in a practical sense, especially as we're heading into colder months with the fall?
Immigrants arriving in New York City, some of whom are asylum seekers and have varying statuses, are a mix of populations So single adults, couples without minor children, families with minor children, and I think a small number of unaccompanied youth. So we have a body of law and regulations that establish minimum requirements for what shelters should look like for those individuals. They are basically people who are arriving in the New York City jurisdiction, which is a local social service district in its own right. And under the state rules, it's required to provide accommodation to the people who are arriving. And those rules for what that looks like are, again, embodied in the regulations that we've been talking about. There have been some suggestion by the city that they don't think they have to follow the rules related to shelters for homeless individuals and families, and that maybe they can have some other kind of facility. But at this point, that would come up against a number of other challenges, including the public health law, the executive law, and the building code. So we await details from the city of New York about exactly what they're thinking here. You know, there have been some rather absurd proposals repeating something that Mayor Bloomberg once advanced, with the idea of housing this population on cruise ships. That presents enormous challenges. And it sends a troubling signal to admit into the community a group of people then that is then immediately segregated, literally off the land.
Why are cruise ships a problematic source of housing? Because I think about the early days of the pandemic, and we had people who we basically, without a better solution, kept on cruise ships off certain shores.
And COVID spread like wildfire in those cruise ships. There were some horrendous situations that happened both on cruise ships and on military vessels that had very large numbers of people living in very close quarters. Novel coronavirus is an airborne pathogen, and air cleaning is not sufficient in a highly dense setting like a cruise ship to clean the air well enough to stop the pathogen from spreading from room to room.
And so I assume you have similar concerns in this situation, and in addition to providing other services that, say, children might need, like schooling for this short-term basis?
Certainly the most integrated scenario would be a purpose-built shelter that is fully complies with state regulations. We recognize that those can't be built overnight, which is why, just as in the pandemic, hotels have been deployed for the purpose of providing a place for families as well as individuals to stay during this rather unprecedented immediate demand for shelter. However, it must also be recognized that New York City's shelter census has been much larger than it is now, even with this influx, as recently as 2019. So it's not as though the city hasn't been able to provide sufficient capacity for a larger number of people. It's just the speed of the arrival. And I will say, I think that as much as we're all upset with the governors in the southern states that have deliberately sought to make a political issue out of immigration by sending people by the busload to other locations, it didn't help for the city of New York, the mayor of the city of New York, to make that accusation against the Texas governor when he wasn't yet doing it. All he did was turn around and start doing it as a result.
Well, speaking of New York City Mayor Eric Adams, he's issued some comments that have then been either retracted or clarified by his administration about the way that the right to shelter law is administered in the future. From your perspective, what do you see as the best way forward for implementing the right to shelter requirements, not just in New York City, but around the rest of the state?
So it's important that the city and state partner in responding to this need. I think one thing that the state can do is restore fair financial participation in reimbursing localities across the state, including New York City, for the non-federal share of the cost of sheltering. I think that's one really important thing the state can do. I think the city has got to get serious about thinking through the solutions that comply with state regulations. I think the idea of creating triage tents as we're going into the cold weather at a time when we still have an airborne pathogen that spreads very easily from person to person. We already know people are arriving on the buses COVID positive. They've got to get serious about a solution that doesn't place people at risk in settings where the virus is going to spread and where they're going to be segregated from the rest of the homeless population, all of whom really should be on the fast track to housing. I know that the people who have been interviewing the recent arrivals know that there are a lot of kind of immediate needs from the trauma of their exodus, but also this is a group of people who came here for a better life, who want to work, and we should be doing everything we possibly can to foster their ability to survive their trek and get on with life here.
In the future, what do you see as the responsible amount of time that municipalities should be keeping someone or offering temporary shelter for before they can get someone into a longer-term housing solution?
So right now, there are some populations that are required to wait 90 days in order to access rental assistance. I think when we've got as much of a demand for shelter and a population ready to move into housing, we probably need to stop having a waiting period for housing vouchers. As I think Mayor Adams, to his credit, has acknowledged, immigrants are the center of New York City life. So offering people an opportunity to get their feet under them without having to wait 3 months is probably one of the single most important things they can do. As for the right to shelter itself, there is no durational time limit and cannot be any durational time limit. The length of stay in shelters has ranged over the years from weeks to months to now years. And that is all because we have an affordable housing crisis that, frankly, none of the mayors since Ed Koch and none of the governors since Mario Cuomo have done an adequate job of addressing.
And for someone who's spending years in a shelter, what does that life consist of, whether you're an adult or a child? Can you kind of paint a picture for us?
Oh my goodness, it's so challenging. Family with children, especially a family with a disabled child whose special education program is in another borough, spends so much of every day traveling back and forth to getting to school. It's not possible under the current situation for every family to be placed in a shelter near where the child has their educational ties and special programs if they have a disability. It presents similar challenges for individuals and adult family members who are working. People don't realize that a large number of people who live in shelters also work for a living, and very often they work overnights. And just merely keeping on top of having a pass that allows you to leave your shelter bed for your shift and come back and not find a stranger sleeping in your bed is yet another challenge that many working homeless people face in a system in New York City that's serving literally tens of thousands of people every night.
There are probably listeners right now who are thinking that the people that you talk about who are children or are working but aren't making enough to find housing, I understand why we should go out of our way to provide housing to them or even help pay for permanent housing. But there's probably someone in their head that they're thinking of who's this person who's a quote-unquote like deadbeat, who's just relying on the system, and by having this sort of safety net ensures that they're never going to pick themselves up by their bootstraps. Is that person someone who exists in the shelter system? And how concerned, if at all, should we be about that scenario?
You know, I ran a shelter for several years before I came to work for the Coalition for the Homeless, and I never met such a person. I met people who were embarrassed by their poverty, who were ashamed to ask for help. I met people who were so beaten down by not being able to get by or by their disabilities that they were giving up. But getting over is just not what happens in the shelter system. That's kind of a separate culture outside the shelter system. People who come into the shelters are usually have already moved in with family and friends, couch surfed, burned through their savings, done everything they can possibly do to stay out of the shelter system before they come in.
Well, then conversely, if someone is listening and they want to support either their local homeless shelter organizations or the Coalition for the Homeless, or just want to make a difference, what would you recommend they do?
So local United Ways often have a directory of local shelters. That's one way to start. And there are a variety of faith-based organizations in every community that are offering those supports. Coalition for the Homeless, we have a website with a wealth of information, coalitionforthehomeless.org, and including online contributions if people wish to make a contribution to our work. We operate a dozen programs serving 3,500 homeless people a day and feed 1,000 people every night on the streets of Manhattan and the Bronx. We provide housing. We inspect the shelters. We're the court-appointed monitor of the shelter system as opposed to an operator of shelters. We operate housing. We operate a children's camp, overnight camp for homeless children. So those are options. I also recommend volunteering. And again, those local United Way and faith-based organizations very often have volunteer opportunities to allow people to meet homeless people face-to-face. And I'll tell you, that is transformative. I've seen so many people volunteer to help homeless people and come away with a really new and profound understanding of what homelessness is all about.
Well, we've been speaking with Shelley Nortz. She's the Deputy Executive Director for Policy at the Coalition for the Homeless, the country's oldest advocacy and direct service organization for homeless individuals and families. Shelley, thank you so much for making the time and for everything you do on this issue.
Thank you so much, David. It was great speaking with you.
Support for Capital Press Room provided by the New York State Department of Agriculture and Markets, working to help consumers identify local agricultural products through the New York Grown and Certified label. More at nysgrown.com.